If you ask anybody in the world of stand-up comedy who they most respected through their careers, I think any one of them in the last 40 years would probably have told you the name George Carlin. Probably in the top three. Maybe Richard Pryor would have been in there. Maybe some of them would have referenced Lenny Bruce, even if they never saw him. That's a name that always was referenced by people in the comedy world. But George Carlin was considered one of the best, one of the most innovative, and one of the most honest comedians, in addition to being one of the most successful for nearly the last half century. We lost George a year and a half ago. He died in June 2008 at age 71. At the time, he was working on his autobiography, a project he'd been working on for many years with his very close friend, Tony Hendra. Tony has a pretty good comedy resume of his own. He was the original editor of the National Lampoon back in the days when that was a magazine, and it was funny. He also was one of the creators of the Broadway show National Lampoon's Lemmings, and you may recognize him as soon as you hear his voice as the guy who walked around with a cricket bat and yelled at Michael McKean and Harry Shearer and Christopher Guest when they were the stars of This Is Spinal Tap. Tony Hendra helped George work on that autobiography, which has now been released posthumously, at least on George's part, as a book called Last Words. Tony Hendra, who is still not posthumous, but here with us today on the Big 550 KTRS. How are you, Tony?
I am prehumous. Very nice to be here.
Nice to have you on the show.
Sure.
Tell me, not how the project started, but how your friendship with George started. Does it go all the way back to the beginning of both of your careers?
Well, it does, actually. We were we first got to know one another in the mid-60s when my partner and I, who were a comedy team, and George were scuffling around the Greenwich Village trying to get jobs and get on television. And we knew one another quite well. I mean, we were sort of competitive, but we tried to get on the Merv Griffin show and all these dreadful variety shows that were that infested the tube in the 60s, like Hollywood Palace and the Perry Como show, and of course the awful, agonizing, ghastly, terrible, torturous Ed Sullivan show.
Wow. I don't think I've ever heard those adjectives applied to the Ed Sullivan show before.
Well, it was pretty awful for comedians. I don't know about singers because I'm not one, but
What made it so horrible?
Well, you couldn't get any laughs. I mean, it was just there were a combination of factors, but it was partly that the audience was almost entirely made up of invited guests, from Ford dealerships on Long Island or whatever the sponsors were for the show, and if there weren't enough of those to go around, they filled the place up with guests from the local mental hospitals. So there were plenty of people laughing, but not in the right places. And, of course, the worst thing of all was Ed, this weird little crab-like creature, would stand, while you were doing your routine, he would stand stage right in a part of the stage that we used to call the crypt, and he would not laugh at your routine. Sometimes he would laugh, very, very slightly, but mostly he wouldn't laugh. And, of course, the audience, which was uptight to start with, was watching him, not you. So, anyway, the whole thing was like playing a mausoleum, and it was so dreadful that we used to call it Night of the Living Ed.
Well, was it because Ed didn't get it? Was it because you and your partner and George and some of the other comedians were kind of changing comedy a little bit, and he wasn't hip enough to understand that? Or was he just a guy who had no sense of humor?
Well, I don't know if he had no sense of humor. I know he was really pretty much out of it. I mean, he really looked like he'd just shut up, frankly. And he was getting kind of sick in those days. But he had a very definite kind of rote sense of humor, which sense of comedy, which was that he was interested in ethnic comedy. I mean, he loved George because George was Irish. He loved us because we were British. He loved Jackie Mason because he was Jewish, and he loved Pat Cooper because he was Italian, and so on and so forth. You know, so long as all the ethnic groups were satisfied, Ed was satisfied. It didn't matter if they were funny or not.
Okay, so you still were, fairly successful, and George certainly was fairly successful, although for anybody who knew George in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, they might not have recognized him in the 60s as a guy who wore a suit on TV and did what were then kind of like the same stand-up routines other people were doing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would say he was sort of in the Bob Newhart kind of category. But like myself and like Richie Pryor and like, I don't mean to compare myself to these gods, but like many of us really at that time, who were doing these heavily censored television shows, we rebelled. We couldn't stand it anymore. And George, of course, transformed himself from being this rather slick, kind of mod young comedian into being this really transformational figure in the early 70s. And I, in a lot more modest way, as you mentioned in your introduction, did very much the same thing by going to the National Lampoon. So it was a generational thing, and I think a lot of it had to do with George wanting to speak in his authentic voice. He'd grown up in Harlem. He'd grown up on the streets. He hadn't finished ninth grade. He'd been in the Air Force and had three court-martials. He hadn't been able to talk about any of this stuff. And he began talking about that stuff and came up with these wonderful albums, Class Clown and Occupation Fool, and his great routines like I Used to Be an Irish Catholic and of course, The Seven Words You Can't Say on Television, which, of course, completely defined the revolution that he'd just, the personal revolution that he'd just gone through.
And was that, you talk about transformation and revolution, was that, he went to bed on a Sunday and he was one guy and he woke up on Monday and decided, you know what? I'm not doing that anymore. Now I'm going to be a new guy. I'm going to start letting my hair grow. It doesn't grow out instantaneously. But right. Was it one of those things where he said, I'm just changing it today? Or was it a transformation that took him a year or two?
Well, it took him several years, actually. And, I mean, he was finding the real George Carlin, as he put it. One way he put it was to say, my hair's always been long, but before it was just inside my head. And but probably the most transformational thing for George, and I have to say this, whether there are people out there who don't like it or not, was dropping acid. He said it was the most extraordinary experience, the most profound self-discovery that he'd ever had. And from then on, he explored this new personality that, to him, of course, was and to us, was the real George Carlin and not the fake one that had appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show.
It's the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris talking with Tony Hendrick, co-author of George Carlin's autobiography, The Last Words. And just to clear something up here, Tony, you can say whatever you want about George.
Okay.
and anything else on this show. Absolutely free will as long as you stay away from the seven words.
There we go. The seven words you can't say on radio.
So we're talking about this transition, and I'm fascinated by this because I remember the routines he did on the Dead Sullivan Show, as you call it, and transformed into the guy who did those brilliant comedy albums that made him, it was pretty much a trifecta of guys. George Carlin, Robert Klein, Richard Pryor, they changed comedy from the late 60s into the early 70s.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm curious about what the reaction was from the people who had been booking George before for comedy gigs. Were there comedy clubs where he could go and he could do that? What was the reaction of the comedy establishment to the new George Carlin?
Well, it was pretty negative. I mean, he went through a period of being fired from. He wasn't really trying anything that daring, but what he was trying was daring enough to get him fired from all his extremely lucrative Las Vegas gigs, for example, he met an enormous amount of resistance, from most of the major television shows of the time. I mean, Johnny Carson wouldn't have him on for a while because he heard that John had gone weird and grown his hair and so forth. I think that's it's a kind of inspiring part of the book where he just sort of sticks to his guns because he knows he's right, and to hell with these people who don't understand what he's doing. I think Robert Klein is a very good person to add to the George and Richard, by the way. All three of them discovered was something very simple, which was that they wanted to be themselves and they wanted to talk directly to the audience. They didn't want to perform sort of sketches Newhart-like bits, you know, for the audience. They wanted to talk to the audience and explain themselves to the audience and talk about real life, talk about the big subjects like war and religion and politics. And that's why they were so inspiring to other people. But it was hard for them to find work. And the main place that they did find work was in this basically new form, which was the college concert, which previously had always been musical, and now was turned into the, you know, the forum for this new kind of comedy.
Yeah. Well, that was the demographic that could relate to them the most and probably absorb them into their own culture as they were absorbed into these comedians' culture at the same time, right?
Exactly. And, I mean, interestingly enough, we George and I became competitors again in the sense that the Lampoon also was very much a campus magazine. I mean, it was... It had as many as 8 million readers a month at its height, and almost all of those were on campus. And similarly, George worked the succession of huge college concerts and concerts which were for college kids. And the other interesting thing about that is that he didn't do television. He performed live, which he continued to do for most of his career, which is, I think, why he had the range and breadth and edge that he had.
We're talking with Tony Hendra, who's the co-author of George Carlin's autobiography, Last Words, which is in bookstores and on Amazon right now. We'll take a break and come back with more. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS. This is the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris, filling in for John Brown again today and for the rest of the week. Chris Gazelle's here with me. We're talking with Tony Hendra, who helped George Carlin work on his autobiography, which just got published last month. It's called Last Words, already a bestseller and full of great stories about one of the all-time great comedians. You two worked on this project for some 15 years, right, Tony?
Yeah, we first began it in the early 90s, actually. The occasion was that George had turned 50 in at the end of the 80s in 87, and he got the autobiography bug, as a lot of people do when they, you know, get to be that age and start looking back on their lives. And so he'd started working on this autobiography, and he wanted to show it to me. So he showed it to me, and it was 100 pages, and the closely typewritten, you know, 100 pages, and it covered only the first 6 months of his life, 6 years of his life. So I said, well, that's great, you know, some funny stuff in here, but by the time you're 60, you know, this book's going to be 1,000 pages long.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, I know that. That's why you're bleeping reading it, you know. And so that's really how we started. He asked me to help him with it, and so began this wonderful, wild, hilarious ride that that never really ended.
And the book literally starts with his birth and takes him
literally,
and
yeah.
goes through his life and his career. We were talking in the last segment about his transformation in the late 60s and particularly into the early 70s. And then I think it was about the mid-70s when cable TV in the form of HBO started coming along and taking guys like George and giving them headline opportunities on TV. How much of a career maker was that exposure?
Well, I think in the long term it was enormously important for George because he ended up doing 14 HBO specials. He would do them biannually. And they certainly are a wonderful reflection of the range and constant innovation that this guy insisted on and practiced. But I think probably I think the first one was actually in 1977 or 78. I can't remember which. HBO was really a very fledgling cable company at that point, and the audience wasn't very large. But one of the main reasons that Michael Fuchs, who was the sort of genius that put HBO together, wanted George in particular, amongst other people, but especially George, was that George had this reputation for speaking the words of the street, if you like to put it that way. And HBO wanted to establish this reputation for taking risks and being daring and being uncensored. And I think that appealed to George immensely. So there was a kind of perfect symbiosis between these two, George's need to speak freely on the one hand, and Fuchs's need to look like a network that espoused the First Amendment in all its implications.
Yeah, well, it was a perfect fit. Just like the college campuses were a perfect fit for him, so was HBO. But there was another aspect of his career that I've always been curious about, which was George Carlin, movie star. He never quite got those two words appended to his name, although he did do work in, you know, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and
right.
Car Wash and a couple of others. Was there a part of him that wanted to be a movie star?
Oh, absolutely. Right from his boyhood, he nursed this kind of well worked out dream by which he would become first a disc jockey, and then a comedian, and then he would move to Hollywood and become a movie star, like either Danny Kaye or Jack Lemmon, who were his two idols. And he actually set about doing it. I mean, at the end of his military career in the Air Force, he actually became a DJ, which prevented him from getting a dishonorable discharge, in fact.
Yep.
And before long, he was, he'd segued into being a comedian. But unfortunately, in the mid to late 60s, when he got his first, he tried his first acting roles. He just said he couldn't do it. He was dismally bad at it. And it's actually a very poignant and also rather funny section of the book where he makes this awful discovery that he just stinks in front, when he's trying to be an actor.
Yeah. He was really good at being George, but not good at being anybody else.
Yes, exactly. And of course, eventually he came back to movies, but there were repetitions of that. He did the very first Saturday Night Live, for example, and he completely refused to do sketches, although sketches were the sort of meat and potatoes of the format that Lorne Michaels was hoping to rely on.
Yep.
And he just did his routines in these little truncated forms. But then he did another Saturday Night Live in 1984. And this time he did sketches and was really very good in them.
Yep.
In fact, it's a very funny story about that, about Billy Crystal, which I won't spoil for you, but who was in the sketches with him. After that, he began to get these quite not sort of starring roles, but substantial acting roles. So the first one he did was Outrageous Fortune with Bette Midler and Shelley Long, I guess.
Yes.
And did a very turn in a very funny and rather charming act as a sort of burnt out old hippie, but the only problem was from then on, he said that was the only role he could get. He was always being cast as a burnt out hippie or some kind of 60s relic,
right.
Which seemed a bit limiting.
If you don't mind, I want to jump off on a tangent here because you mentioned George being the first host October 11th, 1975 of Saturday Night Live. And he did, I think, three, maybe four stand-up routines on that show while the Not Ready for Primetime Players, as they were called, were doing their skits and there was whatever band was on that show. I'm curious, Tony, how you, who were then still part of the National Lampoon magazine, and you were very successful in that part of it, that part of kind of counterculture comedy, if you will, which was starting to become mainstream comedy in this
right.
country. How did you view that first night of Saturday Night Live? Did you see it?
Yes, I did see it. well, that's an interesting question because, you see, we had, as you mentioned in your introduction, I had done an off-Broadway show for the National Lampoon, which is called Lemmings, which actually became quite a big hit. And Lemmings was, just to give it the short kind of description, was basically a full-scale parody of Woodstock, with a lot of acts who hadn't actually been at Woodstock being parodied too. And the three of the people that I cast in that were John Belushi, Chevy Chase, and Christopher Guest, who at that point hadn't had any major major parts. That was their first sort of starring roles.
Mm-hmm.
And John and Chevy also then began, after the Lemmings, to do the National Lampoon Radio Hour. And Belushi ended up running that and bringing in Gilda Radner and Billy Murray and his brother and of course Chevy. So this cast of the radio show was actually sort of plucked almost entirely out of our hands and put onto Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
So the with the exception of Dan Aykroyd and Jane Curtin, we were pretty much responsible for assembling this cast. So there was a certain amount of let's say bittersweet pleasure in seeing their premiere.
In other words, they ripped your guts out, but they started something brand new that really took off.
Yes, exactly.
So you were mad and you were proud at the same time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
but it was very interesting to see George. And I mean, I love the fact that George did. He made Lorne Michaels very nervous. Made this television revolutionary extremely nervous by doing these routines about God, how God couldn't be all powerful because he'd never made two mountains alike, and couldn't make two snowflakes alike, and so forth and so on, and why did if you had Jesus on your dashboard, why did he face you and not the traffic? I mean, it's very funny stuff, and but quite daring,
yep.
Really, for the time.
Absolutely.
And he was hardly off the air when they got a call from, I guess it would have been Cardinal Spellman's office, demanding to know, what this was and the retraction and an apology from NBC and so forth. George is very happy about that.
I'm sure he was. Another thing I know about that night was that George was seriously coked up, which we will talk about in the next segment because I want to get into a little bit of the dark side of George's drug use,
right.
Which may have hastened the end of his life, unfortunately. So we'll talk more about that in a moment with Tony Hendra, the co-author of George Carlin's autobiography, Last Words, here on the Big 550 KTRS. This is the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris, filling in for John Brown today and talking with Tony Hendra, who worked with George Carlin on George's autobiography, Last Words. They weren't able to get it finished before George died in June of last year at age 71. So Tony decided, as a tribute to his friend, he was going to finish it up. And so they came out with it last month, and it is an absolutely terrific read. It takes George literally from the moment of his birth through so much of his life and his career. And it even touches on the dark side of George's drug use, which I mentioned in the last break. He was coked up on that night that he was doing the first Saturday Night Live in October of 1975. And back even before that, Tony mentioned that he had dropped acid a few years before that, and that had kind of helped give him a different worldview. But in the early 80s, that really, really started to catch up with him, didn't it, Tony?
Yeah, I mean, I think there were many factors here, but it's certainly in 1982, he had a really severe near-fatal heart attack, and obviously that was it was partly genetic. His father had died of a heart attack at quite an early age, but he'd also been doing coke in massive quantities pretty much throughout the 70s. And obviously that puts a tremendous strain on the old cardiac system. I'm sure it was a contributory factor to his subsequent heart attacks. Although by 1982 he had pretty much given up cocaine. He was unapologetic about using drugs and right up until, I think, not his death, but I mean certainly to a few years before his death, he regarded marijuana, for example, as a very useful tool for editing his own material. I guess you could say that he would have done better material if he hadn't been smoking dope. But on the other hand, it was pretty good, as it is. So I think it's a two-edged sword. I mean, the other thing too is that at least in the book, he's pretty funny and brutally honest, but pretty funny about what an idiot he was when he was on this stuff, and there are quite a few pretty funny stories about that.
Yeah, when he was such a heavy cokehead, Well, did it affect his work there in the late 70s or early 80s?
Yes, I think that's probably the... I think cocaine is very destructive of creative effort, actually, even though it appears that you think you're being creative, you really aren't. And this wonderful transformation that he brought out such great material in the early and mid-70s, you know, by his own account, became very kind of introspective, and as he put it, he was reduced in this sort of observational humor that he kind of pioneered. He was reduced to, as he put it, plundering his own body, and you know, telling the audience about bodily functions, and that was about as insightful as he got. And again, he was capable of being funny about his own shortcomings, but he certainly hit hit what he called a trough, or to put it another way, he called it the second visitation of the Straits in the late 70s, which I best evidenced really by the fact that he almost ended up hosting. No, he didn't. He did actually host the Tonight Show many, many times in that period.
Yeah.
But you know, I think this is a sort of testament to the guy's depth, was that he overcame that too, and then began. What was really a major second transformation in the early 80s, and especially after his heart attack, in developing this character or persona or voice that we all came to know and love, which was the mature George Carlin.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, you know, they say there are no second acts in American life, but George had a second and a third act. The artist that he became by the early 90s, I think, deserves the term artist. I mean, as I say in my introduction, it's as inadequate to call George a comedian as it is to call B.B. King a guitarist.
And yet some of his critics, particularly in the last decade of his life, complained that he seemed a little bit angrier and more bitter on stage. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's truth to that? And the other part of it is, did George care what his critics said?
Well, I certainly, by the aughts, or whatever we call this decade, I don't think he did care. I mean, I think he cared only for his audience, about whom he was very careful and very respectful. He never, if you like, read his own reviews. But I think the word bitter is possibly charged with a certain amount of political disagreement on the one hand,
mm-hmm.
In the sense that he made no secret of his contempt for consumerism and for militaristic foreign policy and so forth, which doesn't please everybody, and that he was happy that it didn't please everybody. So I think that's one part of it. The other is a very interesting passage that speech that he gave me once, which is he said, I believe in the sledgehammer, not the rapier, because when I look around me, I see that what's happening to people is not delicate and rapier-like. It's blunt and crude, like a sledgehammer. And he said, you know, the more violent the violence around us is as much about poverty and lack of health care and lack of education as it is about a guy who goes into McDonald's with an Uzi and kills 40 people. And the more violent and aggressive the society becomes, the more violent and aggressive, you know, an artist has to become to reflect it. So I think that's one of the reasons why this much stronger and more, some people would say extreme, I would say intense, material began to appear towards the end of his life.
And yet, while he was trying to reflect that and being that comedic sledgehammer, and he did touch on grand issues in the large scale, he was never anything anybody could ever call a topical comedian. Why didn't George Carlin do topical humor?
Well, it's a very, very ordinary reason. He hated to throw things away. And he was a self-described anal maniac. And he loved to keep things and have them... you know, have them neat and tidy up on the shelf, and, you know, I've done that. There we go. And he said the problem with topical humor is that you can work on it and work on it, which he worked on his stuff to the point of fanaticism to get it right. And by the time you've got it right, there are no laughs coming back because it's not in the news anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very true. And it's of course, there are brilliant topical comedians. One of his mentors, Mort Sahl, was certainly that. And one of our best commentators, Jon Stewart, is brilliant at it. But
mm-hmm.
But I think what it did for George was it kind of edited out a number of unimportant things so that he could, in fact, concentrate on the big subjects. And I think that's what makes him a great artist, is that he did deal with big subjects like God and religion and war and hypocrisy and abortion and so forth, and deal with them in a way that, you know, was not only very, very funny, but also extremely incisive. And, I mean, one of those is, for example, his what should we call it, essay on environmentalism called The Planet is Fine, The People Are Screwed.
Yeah.
Which I think is one of the, it's not that long, but it's one of the best pieces I've ever heard or read, because his pieces would read beautifully.
Yes.
About that particular issue. And in describing it in the book, he said something very interesting. He said, when I did that, he did it first in 1992 in what he was always his favorite HBO special, Jammin' in New York. He said, once I wrote that and started performing it, I realized that I didn't just have an obligation to my audience to make them laugh. I also had an obligation to engage their minds. And he said that was an incredibly liberating discovery because as a writer, he wrote all his own stuff, and as an artist, it meant he now had the license to deal with things and to engage his audience's mind as well as their belly laughs.
Well, Tony, I appreciate your time here today, and I will tell you, having read the book and having talked to you a few times now, you have done a great job of preserving the George Carlin legacy for everyone, for generations to come, and
thank
I congratulate you.
You
on that. And
Thank you so much.
We have only touched on a tip of the iceberg of Carlin's life here today. For the rest, you really have to read this book. It's called Last Words by George Carlin and his friend Tony Hendrith. Thank you very much, Tony. Have a great finale to 2009.
Okay, same to you. Thank you, Paul.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.